So this is the first. And you probably realise that Greenbelt is celebrating its 40th birthday. And we want to mark, I'm going to read this, it's a lot easier. We want to mark our birthday by starting a fund that will last so we can secure the next 40 years of Greenbelt for the next generation and for generations to come. So we can make good on the adage that life begins at 40. There are a few ways you can take part in the celebrations, and they're on a postcard that it tells me I'm meant to hold up, but I don't have the postcard. Does anyone have a postcard they can hold up? No, and that's my phone, which is also a bit embarrassing. Okay. Well, it was Rick, actually, who I was speaking to a minute ago. Okay, sorry about that. Right. Here's a postcard. So, in there is everything you need to know. Thank you very much. And check out the festival guide for exciting programme of birthday events. So, the highlights are Sunday Communion, there's a film premiere of Greenbelt at 40, and there's a big birthday bash on Saturday night, and the Monday all-age birthday party. So there you go, 40 years. So why are we here? We're here for a debate that you're going to be taking part in and these guys are going to be taking part in. A debate on what's the purpose of marriage. And I've been thinking about this over the last 9 months and I haven't come up with the answer yet. So I'm really, really looking forward to this. Maybe there isn't an answer, who knows. I'm going to hand over to Margaret, who's chairing this evening, back from chairing a very successful debate last year, so very pleased to see her. And apparently I have to call you ladies and gentlemen. Anyhow, ladies and gentlemen, Margaret Wallace.
Welcome to the first Greenbelt debate on what is the purpose of marriage. I'm delighted this evening to have a fantastic panel of people. They have all emailed me. One is married, one is not married, and one has not vouchsafed their marital status. All will become clear later. The format of the evening is for all of us to be involved, and each of the panel members in turn is going to set out their stall. And then you, as the audience and the other panel members, will have a chance to question them very briefly. And then we'll move on to the next person, and they'll set out theirs, and finally the third. And once we get all through all three, then it'll be free and open for everybody to take part. I hope it'll be a raging success. There's an awful lot to talk about with what is the purpose of marriage. So with no more ado, I'm going to introduce the panel members. The first of whom is Marika Rose, who has not vouchsafed her marital status, or didn't in her email. Marika is a PhD student at Durham, although apparently now working at Newcastle. Oh, somebody from Durham over there. Her thesis is on the theology of failure, although she's also interested in feminist and political theology. So I'm going to pass to Marika.
Okay. When Christians talk about marriage, I think we're very good at remembering the bits in the Bible that suggest that it's a good thing and suggest that it's a gift from God. But we're not always so good at talking about the bits that seem to have a rather different view of marriage. So, for example, when Jesus says he's come to turn family members against each other and that his real family aren't his actual family but the people who do the will of God, or when Paul says it might be better for people not to marry. Christianity has historically been very ambiguous about marriage. The church has often valued practices like celibacy, which form the basis for communities that are distinguished from the rest of society, precisely because they aren't based around marriage and the family. But more recently, I think, that ambiguity has been replaced by a tendency to affirm marriage, to see it as something that needs defending, as something that's good because it holds society together. And I think that once we start seeing marriage as an unambivalent good, we're in trouble. Yes, marriage holds society together. But the society it holds together is one in which power and wealth are unevenly distributed, in which women's work is undervalued, and in which women themselves remain very vulnerable, especially in the context of marriage and the family. It's a society in which people's access to property, education, and opportunities are unjustly shaped by their race, class, and nationality, to name just a few things. So I am married, and since I got married, I've been able to do things that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise because my husband earns more money than me. And I worry less about the future because he has a pension and I don't. In my work, I've noticed that I get treated as less of a threat by the men I work with because being married gives me a kind of safe and respectable status. I'm constantly asked by people in church who don't know me very well when I'm going to have children, because that's what married people do, right? And recently, someone I love and respect sat me down to tell me that although I was a very good theologian, there were some things I would simply never understand until I became a mother. And all of those experiences worry me in different ways. It's just not true that marriage is a universal feature of human life. It does very different things in different societies. It has very different roles in the way that we think about gender, sexuality, ethics, work, property, and class, to name just a few. And so if we want to think about the purpose of marriage, I think there are two questions we need to ask. What role does marriage play in our lives and in our society now? And what would it look for marriage to be transformed by the breaking in of the kingdom of God? So what's the purpose of marriage? I think it depends.
Thank you, Marina. Okay. Would Chris or John like to respond in any way, shape, or form? There, that's putting him on the spot.
No, I think that this, what you said about the Bible is very interesting because, you know, many marriages begin with marriage is a holy estate hallowed by our Lord's presence at the wedding in Cana of Galilee. All we know was that he was there at the reception. And you could build a very good case for either bigamy or plurality of wives if you go to Abraham or David or Solomon, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, there's a boy who knows about marriage. And we cannot, you know, erect a theology of marriage and not hide from the fact that actually little about it is said in Scripture. The only time Jesus ever talks about marriage is when he's involved in a question about divorce. That's the only time.
Thanks, John. Chris, do you want to have any kind of...
And I'm glad, Marika, that you've contextualized it within social inequality, that it's clear in a number of different ways marriage has been one of the prime tools for making sure that a woman's place is well and truly in the wrong.
I have to say it resonated with me. My mother-in-law started to have dreams after I'd been married about 7 years that I was pregnant. She got a bit desperate, I think. Any questions or comments from the audience? And there's a roving mic. Yep. Are you all silenced? Oh, there's a...
You mentioned that the men you work with tend to treat you differently now they know that you're married. Do women treat you differently in any way? And is that negative or positive?
I don't know, actually. I've been married about 6 years now because I got married weirdly young. And so it's been a while since I've not been married. I think one of the things that worries me about being married is the way that that makes other people feel around you. So I've definitely noticed that it does kind of weird things to your relationships with people who aren't married. It makes it harder for them to feel included sometimes. It makes it difficult to do dinner parties because you want kind of even numbers, but you don't want to like look like you're setting people up, and that sometimes becomes complicated. Maybe that says something about my class and how that works in my life. Yeah, so I think I kind of worry about the way that it makes people outside my marriage feel and relate to me. And I think I've definitely had friends who've said that, who've come out of difficult relationships and said it's been really difficult to be around people who are happily married. So yeah, in lots of different ways, I think it probably shapes things.
There's one in the front here.
I on. Hello. Sorry. You mentioned that your answer was it depends. At the end of the day, you know, marriage has a lot of baggage and it perpetuates these inequities. What's the purpose of your marriage? And what does it mean to you to reflect Christ in your marriage?
It's funny, like I said, I got married 6 years ago, and I think probably I hadn't really thought very much about what marriage was at that point. You know, I loved Jim, who's now my husband, and we went out, and that was great, and I was like, yes, this is the person I want to spend my life with, because that was the model I had for relationships. And so I feel like in a lot of ways, it was a decision I'd made before I really understood what marriage was. And I'm not saying I regret it, I really don't, but I do have lots of questions, actually. One of the things that's happened in my marriage is that we've moved around the country a lot for various reasons to do with our jobs, and that's meant that we've moved away from friends who've been really important in my life, and I feel like that's unsatisfactory to me in some ways. Like, it's great to have one person who I'm committed to enough that we get to always be together, and so I don't turn up in a new place completely on my own, but I sort of wish that there were ways to have more kind of stable commitments to other friends in some ways, I think. It worries me the way that a lot of the time a marriage becomes kind of the smallest unit that we break communities down into. So you can move married couples around, but they can't take their friends with them. And I think that has really damaging effects in a lot of ways, not least because actually in a marriage, I don't think you can just count on each other. Like, if I just had to spend all my time with my husband, I think he would go crazy, and I would go crazy, and it would be terrible. We need other people around us. And so actually, we talk about marriage as though it's this unit of two people, and it's never that. None of our relationships are. They're always caught up into bigger networks. And I think I get really excited by ideas of trying to work out what it means to do community with bigger groups of people than just the people in your marriage and your children. And I don't know what that would look like, and I haven't lived anywhere long enough with a stable enough job to actually do anything about it. But I do wonder if there's something kind of there that is good that we miss out on in the way that we currently do marriage.
I'm going to pass on to the next person because we're going to have lots of opportunity to come back. So remember all those points you want to make. But I'm going to pass on now to John Bell, who I'm sure doesn't really need an introduction, but also had the shortest biography I've ever read, which was, I will read it out, John Bell is a resource worker with the Iona community. He has never been married. John Bell.
Well, one could say quite a lot of things about the purpose of marriage. You could say that it's there to remind us when virginity used to end. Or you could say that marriage is there so that people can discover whether or not they're gay. Because if you can't get married, you must be gay. But moving rapidly on to something of a little more gravity. I have three things which I want to kind of touch on. The first is that I believe that marriage is important as a socially and politically recognized relationship in which people who are committed to each other show that love is more than feeling. Because love is more than feeling. It's about decisions which are made together, which might please one and not please the other, but they're made out of love. It's about dealing with stuff which you could run away from and avoid. But because you're married, then you have to work through it. And I believe that society has a right to endorse and to encourage that kind of relationship, so that the way in which we live is not purely subjective, but there are some people who feel called to this kind of relationship, who are prepared to exhibit to other people that there's a value in love which is more than just feeling. The second thing is difficult to say, and I don't know whether I'll be able to say it clearly, but I believe that creativity works best when there are constraints. Artists and musicians given a blank canvas and told you can do what you like, sometimes end up very frustrated. But when you know that there are parameters in which you have to live or work, then great things can happen. And I believe that within marriage, there is a liberation. Now, I speak of somebody who's not married, but I've seen this in people. There is a liberation which I can just vaguely remember when I used to date people years and years ago. I remember thinking, thank goodness I'm with somebody now, because I don't need to think about anybody else who I might fancy. Now, that's a kind of daft thought. But there was that notion that if this is a person who I'm committed to, there's a whole world that opens up of possibility here. And it's much preferable to the anarchy of never having anything which is stable. And the third thing is to do with children. I don't believe that marriage is there so that people can have children. But I believe that marriage is there so that children know to whom they belong. And our identity is forged by our genes and our connections with those who bring us into the world and who rear us. And I believe that every child has a right to know those who are his or her parents, and through them to begin to develop a life which is responsible if the model is good, or which reacts against the model if the model is bad. But not to know where you've come from, whether you were adopted or not, not to feel that there's an extended family to which you have a relationship, is a kind of anarchy which I don't think is good for children. And I suppose the final thing is, last week I was doing, I don't do this often, I mean I've got big reasons for not doing marriages, one of which is I don't stay long enough in the same place for people to get to know each other. But I was working in a church in Amsterdam where I work in the summer, and was asked to do the blessing of a wedding of a Russian Orthodox couple from Kazakhstan who had fallen in love in Amsterdam, got married, a state marriage, and wanted to have a church blessing. And in Holland, all marriages are done by the state, and the church is a blessing. And there was this lovely text, which I've never used before, from Ecclesiastes, which says that two are better than one. If one lies in a bed by oneself, how can you keep warm? But two can keep each other warm. And then it says, and a cord of three strands is difficult to break. And I believe that at least in Christian marriage, we're dealing with three strands. We're dealing with the strand of the male, we're dealing with the strand of the female, and we're dealing with the strand of God who we invite in to make sacred this connection. And that's something which I believe is special and worth encouraging.
Thank you, John. Any response from the other members of the panel?
I have two things I think I would want to say in response. One is that I think I agree with a lot of the things that you're saying about what is good about marriage, but it's less clear to me that those things are exclusively good about marriage and not about other forms of stable, committed relationships that do exist in the world. And I worry about what happens when we talk about marriage as though it's the best way for families to be structured. I worry about that, what that does to the families who are structured differently, through choice or through necessity or through relationships going wrong. And I worry about what happens in church communities when people feel like they are failing because their husbands left them or because their family doesn't, for whatever reason, look like it's supposed to. And I think this idealization of marriage often has massive problems, and it works out politically. So in America, for example, one of the things that happened under slavery was a huge disruption to the way that relationships were structured amongst people who'd been slaves. People were constantly uprooted from their families and moved around, and you still see the wounds of those changes in black communities. And if you read particularly kind of black queer theory coming from the States, they're talking about the way that kinship works differently in a way that's been shaped by history, and yet at the same time they're constantly told by the society and the government that they're failing because their marriages aren't structured like we think marriages are structured. And so I worry about what happens to marriages that don't conform to this model, and how we deal with that. And then I think the other thing that strikes me is that often when Jesus talks about the family, he deliberately sets up the community of the church in opposition to natural families. And so he says, if you want to follow me, you have to leave your father and mother. He talks about turning children against their parents and parents against their children. And so I think there's a sense in which the sort of community that the church is actually radically undermines natural families. And I don't fully know what to do with that, but I do think it's important to kind of realize that there's some kind of tension there.
Chris.
I'm very much with you about creativity thriving within constraint. And I make my main living as a psychotherapist. I'm fierce about the constraints I place around the therapy. I run groups particularly, but I work with individuals and couples. And at times I'll be really, apparently I think, very harsh in insisting on things like a session starting on time and on a session finishing on time. But within the session, people can talk about whatever they want in whatever way they want. And it's my long, long experience that it's the strength of the constraint that allows proper therapy to occur. And any good therapist will be very, very fierce in protecting the constraints of the therapy. So in terms of what you were saying, Marika, I also agree that marriage is not the only way to do some of these things. But one of the ways in which it's privileged is because there are clear constraints around it, which creates possibility. And there are other ways of doing the same things, but you need to build in similar kinds of constraints. You need, when living in community, for instance, to have a clear understanding of the nature of the relationship. And it's the introduction of whatever you want to call it, contracting, agreement, covenant, where you know the edges of something are, that create a space within which all sorts of fertility arrives.
Thank you, Chris. Anybody got any questions? In the front row. Don't know where's the lollipop?
Claire, you've been called many things, but a lollipop is not fair.
It's not even a lollipop. We haven't got one yet.
A gentleman asked Marika about her relationship with her husband and brought Christ into the question. And John, you talked about the three-stranded cord, and these references to Christ being present in a marriage create a kind of hallowed idea of this covenant relationship between two people, which at the moment is a man and a woman. I've just attended your earlier talk, and I just wonder whether when we hallow marriage as a covenant relationship, and I take your point about the structure and limit and so on, when we hallow marriage so highly, we diminish all other forms of Christian covenant and relationships. And I wonder if we're giving too much an unfair weight to the bits of scripture that describe that and not to all the other forms of agape love that ought to be practiced in the church and that is almost off the record. Do you think I've got a point?
Oh, no, I think you do have a point. I don't think the marriage is for everybody, and I wouldn't elevate it to a status which is beyond its capacity to fulfill. And, there are other clear indications of relationships within Scripture which has to do with trust and mutuality and all the rest of it. I mean, that means that we really have to investigate what love is about, which I think is sometimes denigrated by seeing it as the feeling thing. The other thing which picks up something that was said earlier is that one of the reasons why, and here I agree with Marika, Jesus seems to put the relationship between in the church of people to each other on a plane which is as high as marriage is a purely sociological thing. At the time of Christ, one in four women died giving birth to children. One in three children died at childbirth. The average age of adult life was about 35. And of live births, only 5% went on beyond the age of 45. And so the church becomes a surrogate family in which people will find that kind of attentiveness by adults or by surrogate grandparents or by brothers and sisters, which they might not be able to get because the family unit has broken up.
Thank you. Any more questions just for John? Oh, one over there.
I was fascinated, John, that you mentioned the patriarchs and the number of wives and concubines they had. Do you not think that, that the whole nature of marriage has changed over many centuries? And do you think that three strands should be not necessarily male-female in God, but male-male in God or female-female in God?
Yes, I think that that's possible. I think the reasons, I don't want to get, I'm happy to do it later. I think the reasons that are for that are perhaps different from what you anticipate. But if one concedes that people's sexual orientation is not a choice but a given, and that the attraction to someone else who has also that given is something which is profound, then I see no reason why people should not then invite the blessing and presence of God within that relationship.
Thank you. I'm going to pass on to our third speaker now, Chris Powell, who's given a bit of an indication already of what he is, but he describes himself as a group analyst, a type of psychoanalyst who works mainly with groups and organisations, and until last year was head of psychological therapies at the Retreat in York, a Quaker-founded psychiatric hospital. He now works independently in Leeds and York, and much of his work is with, as a psychotherapist with couples. He is married with two children, and the first 17 years of his married life was lived in intentional Christian community. Chris Powell.
I think the purpose of marriage is to fulfill some of the needs that are fundamental to the nature of being human. And I think there are three such needs I want to mention. Firstly, the need for social relationship. Group analysis was founded by S.H. Fuchs, and in the 1940s he propagated what was quite a radical view at that time, which is that the idea of an individual is an abstraction. That we are born out of a relationship, we're born into a relationship, we live in relationships. You cannot think about any individual without thinking about all the people around them. The notion of an individual is, in a way, a nonsense. Where there is no relationship, there is no person. And this reminds us of an early biblical idea that it wasn't good for God's first created human to be alone. So, firstly, we need relationships. Secondly, we also need to resolve quite deep feelings and desires. Freudian drive theory is pretty much out of fashion these days, but there are feelings and desires that many of us have deep within our hearts. There's a longing, for instance, for some of us, for someone else to sort things out for us, for someone else to take care of us. Or a longing to be the most important person. Or the sense that there's something missing, and if we could find it, everything would make sense. Now, I happen to think that a lot of these feelings emerge from our experience of our early relationships, particularly our early dyadic relationship, one-to-one relationship with a mother or with a primary caregiver. And at its best, a marriage provides a kind of a vehicle, a kind of dyadic relationship, a one-to-one relationship that echoes that early relationship, but in a more mature, adult, and a more mutual way. And it's something that allows us to continue to address those really quite deep feelings. And thirdly, we do have very strong need for strong attachments to both for ourselves and for infants. Attachment theory examines the common experience that our early attachments have an impact on the way we develop as people. You can see this where it goes wrong. For people who go on to develop severe personality disorders, almost always, almost without exception, you will find there's been significant disruption in early attachments. You also see it when it goes right. I would stand a bet with you that almost always when you meet someone who is relatively content, relatively useful in their life, making a contribution, that somewhere in their history you'll find at least one good, strong attachment with someone. And in my view, marriage provides one way to provide that kind of a stable configuration. It's a stable configuration to increase the likelihood of strong attachments early in life. Someone in a good relationship is better able to provide a good relationship to a baby. It's also the case that two pairs of hands are often more useful than one, and it's also my experience that actually three pairs of hands often work better than two. So marriage itself is not exclusive and it's not enough. So in my view, marriage is a process. It's not an act. We become married to someone else over a lifetime. And while it's not the only way to do it, it is a fundamental way to become more mature and to become more able to relate to others. It's also a pretty useful way, reflecting a bit of what John said, to introduce new humans into the community of humanity. Becoming married is not the only way to fulfill these needs, and it's not sufficient on its own. But it's the impulse of these needs that I think drives many of us to want to enter into that kind of long-term exclusive relationship with another.
Thank you, Chris. Any comments from John and Rika? John?
Well, I think there's two things I'd like to pick up. One is to do with, you know, Chris saying that marriage is not an exclusive relationship. And I think that's very important. I mean, I have very profound relationships with married women and with married men. And in no way at all does it jeopardize their relationship to their husband or their wife. We cannot completely fulfill all our desires and yearnings with one person. I mean, we were made for community. We weren't just made for, you know, for each other in an individual sense. We're made for community. And any marriage which excludes allowing people, the husband or the wife or the partner, to be engaged with other folk is a very jealous relationship and will be a very harmful relationship. The other thing I wanted to pick up was the thing about, you know, how it's important to have someone who cares for us and satisfies our needs. I think I would want to put a caveat on that. Because I've seen people get married, and people here may have heard similarly when they say, oh, we'll get married and it'll be all right. Yeah? And then they get married and it's all wrong. And it's partly because these individuals are unable to love themselves. And they expect that in marriage they'll give this gift of the self which they don't like to somebody else and expect them to make up for their own failure to love themselves. And it's interesting, you know, when Jesus talks about love, he says that we should love our neighbor as we love ourselves. And it would seem to me that if I were making a kind of religious prerequisite for marriage, one of the things would be, do you love yourself? Because if you don't love yourself, then don't get married. You're putting a burden on another person, which is intolerable.
Thank you. Rika.
I think I would just want to say that the thing about this idea that marriage is a kind of really close relationship, that this person's a really good friend, is in a lot of ways quite historically anachronistic. It just hasn't been the case for a lot of history that there's been this expectation that the person that you marry will be your best friend, will even be someone who's a really close friend. And there's a great book called The Myth of Mars and Venus. I can't remember the author. And she talks about this kind of popular self-help book trope where men and women speak different languages. And she mentions an interview that someone did in the 50s with blue-collar women in America. And they asked these women who their best friends were and who the people were that they'd go and talk to about problems, about worries they had.
I think we're all still okay.
You can only go so far with blasphemy, can't you? God can take a joke, but you know.
I think we can carry on.
Carry on.
Are you all right? Right.
Great. So basically these women said that the people that were their best friends, that they would talk to most about the things that were going on in their lives, were their female friends. They weren't their husbands. And it's not that I think it's bad that we should want to have marriage be a place where there's a really close relationship and we can talk about things, but I think when we talk about that and we don't talk about the other things it does, it kind of gives us a slightly skewed idea of what's going on. So you don't need to read many Anthony Trollope novels to know that often a marriage is a way of passing on property. Often it's a way of managing a kind of family business. So for a lot of history, you would have needed a couple to kind of run things when people mostly lived on farms and things like that. And so at best, I think that idea of a close relationship is one part of it. And I think for a lot of people and for a lot of history, it hasn't been part of it. So when we talk about marriage, I think it's really important that we realise that if that's what we want marriage to be, it certainly isn't always that.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is continue to have just one or two questions specifically for Chris, and then we'll open it out to everybody. So right over the back there.
As a minister, I marry a lot of people, mostly who are already in a covenant relationship in the sense that they have a mortgage, most of which have children and have pensions and all the rest of it. What am I doing when I marry them when they've already got a covenant relationship?
Well, you see, I don't think you're marrying them. And, I mean, that would be my response to John's point, that I think, in a way we do day to day, but I think John possibly used the word marriage where he might have used the word wedding. A wedding's an act. And I think one of the things that you do is you give them a wedding. A wedding does lots of things. I think marriage is something you become. It's a process. So I would agree with you that I think most of the people that you're describing in that way are already becoming married. And I would argue 27 years on, I'm still becoming married. I don't think I'm fully married yet. And
is Mrs. Powell here?
No, she's not. Ms. Mackay is.
Oh, right. Oh, sorry.
And I think one of the things you're doing is exactly, again, what was mentioned earlier, which is you're making the public declaration. So you're setting something before the community, before society, and indeed before the law. Now, whether that's the only way to structure it, whether the way we currently have in British law is the best way of structuring it, and that's, you know, we can talk about that if you want. But I love a party. I turned 50 last year. It's very, very tempting to ignore that, isn't it? Just to let something slip by. But actually, it was an important moment to mark, I think. I carry around in my wallet the ticket from being in Cardiff in March 2012 when Wales destroyed the French and we picked up the Grand Slam. Our lives are made up of such moments, and the day of a wedding is clearly, you know, a really significant moment. So I think you are doing something very important for them. You're also doing that thing which is inviting people. I wish it was a bit more like christenings or dedications sometimes, where we made a bigger deal out of what's going to be looked for from the rest of the community to be part of that. So weddings are important, but they're not the same as getting married, I think.
Thanks. Another question specifically for Chris.
Yeah, I was in the, I think I was in the West Stand at the same time. The one thing you didn't mention, and there was a cross-reference in terms of Freud, is sex. It would obviously have to take a minister to raise this point in his discussion. And we've had different, obviously very different viewpoints from the three of you. And clearly the fact of sex before marriage is not a new one. We may recognise it much more in terms of the covenant relationships we've already talked about, and so on. But I know that one of my sets of grandparents had to get married because my grandmother was expecting. Luckily, they're both long dead, so they're not going to get upset with me now. But this has always been the case. And to some extent, marriage perhaps has also been used to control sex, or at least to ensure a supply of sex, shall we say, for the men, while they could also perhaps try elsewhere. But surely there is... Is sex part of marriage? Clearly, at a certain point, and for certain people, it may never be part of it, but is it a key part of marriage and part of it good in terms of, if not containing sex within the marriage relationship, at least providing some form of boundary?
Chris?
Yes, I mean, if the question is sex part of marriage, absolutely. If the question is, does having sex constitute becoming married? I suspect not. And should sex only happen within a marriage? Well, you know, I'm not much of a theologian. I think the best defense I could reach for would be that one about casting the first stone. It's a very interesting thing to talk about, but I'll be blunt. I've never in the church had as honest a conversation about sex as I have with people in therapy, in therapy groups that I run, and in my own therapy. And, you know, one of my experiences is that somehow there's something about sex that makes, that's harder for us to talk about within the church. And that's worth examining. And I'm not sure that's very much to do with marriage. I think it might be something else.
An interesting experience in Rwanda, doing some work with pastors on pastoral theology. And I said, do you, if a couple comes to you and the girl is pregnant, will you marry them? And they said, yes, of course, because they have already become one flesh. And so they're already married. The wedding is simply the public statement of what has happened. So I thought, that's very cool, that's great. You know, I said, how does it work? They said, well, we wait until the baby is born. Right. And then what? Well, you know, if there's a problem with the birth, then they'll get married. Ah.
Thank you. What I'd like to do now, I think, is to open it out, because you are the fourth member of the panel. So we can engage in a debate across the panel and across the audience and in every which way. So I'd like to open it out to the panel and the fourth. I'm afraid you're going to do a lot of running around.
Okay. Ooh, on the principle.
Claire's from the north. She's used to going up hills.
I'm going right to the very back, because it's not fair being right at the very back. You never get to ask a question. Where are we?
Thank you. I want to ask a question about the constraint and the freedom that brings sometimes that constraint. I work with domestic violence, and sometimes it's actually worked the other way around. And the question I want to ask is, what can we do as Christians in the way we speak and act to make sure marriage is not over people? I was very concerned last year or 2 years ago when all the marriage campaign started, because I think for some people, marriage can become a container where abuse happens and there is no freedom. So I don't want to speak against marriage, but I just want to make sure we are aware that it can become the opposite of freedom. And what can we do as, in the way we speak about it and in the way we act to avoid that?
Would any of you like to respond?
My thought is that in that sense, marriage is the same as any other relationship. And I was saying, I think one of the drives for it is it because it echoes a particular kind of a relationship. And again, we know very sadly that relationships between adults and children, and particularly between parents and children, can often be abusive or exploitative or imbalanced. And I think it's not so much what we can do in terms of what we say. What I'd be arguing for all the time, I'm a group analyst. I like talking with people in groups. I like being with this larger group, but my only disappointment is we're using these things to talk through, so we can't have a normal conversation. And actually, one of the ways that marriages stop being abusive or stop being imbalanced or is when people talk, and don't just, well, firstly talking to themselves, talking to each other, but talk with others, and don't exclude other people from that relationship. And again, that to me, if somehow there's a rule that says we can't talk about what goes on inside our marriage, outside the marriage, there's already something going wrong. It needs to be possible to talk about all of our relationships with other people with whom we're in relationship. So if you're asking what can we do, let's talk more about it. Let's talk about sex a lot more, certainly, and let's talk a lot more about what it's like to be a woman who's married and a woman who isn't married, mm-hmm. and all the other configurations we want to have.
Hi, my name is Christine. I'm from Canada. I work in a school, and we actually have health and careers classes where we talk about this sort of thing around violence in relationships, but in a way that's preventative and kind of coming at it before you get to the point where you're married with someone. in our grade 8 curriculum, which is like 13-year-olds, we start talking about what our values are in friendships. What do we value in our relationships with a friend? Who makes a good friend? What makes a good friend? And then we start to extend that. How does that differ with your parent? Is it all right ever to see violence against another person in a relationship, or to have someone be violent against you in any way? And to take that over the years and part of the curriculum, to go into relationships that are romantically involved, and to go into marriage with that. We don't actually talk about marriage in high school so much, but part of the church that I go to, we have a Word Is Out group, and in Canada, two men can be married and two women can be married, and it's been a few years, not quite a decade. And we started talking. I went to The Word Is Out, and we had this lovely professor, Dr. Martin Brokenleg, and I don't know if it was his model or someone else's model, and he was talking about this triangle in relationships where you have the social and the passion and the intellect, and that in that triangle you're going to find that your partner is going to meet your needs in part of that, but maybe not all of it or a little bit of everything, and that in that triangle you can find a place for your relationships, but that you need all three to be a healthy person in relationship. And so I'm just thinking that that kind of crosses back across.
Thank you. There's somebody just in front of you, I think.
This is really picking up on John's response to Chris. It seems that one of the classic forms of failed relationship is when the woman entered into it thinking that she could change the man and was entitled to do so, which I suppose is non-physical abuse. Could somebody comment on this?
Would one of you like to? Would one of the audience like to comment?
I'm a bit troubled by the gendered way that you asked that question. I think it comes back to what Chris was talking about, this idea that someone in a marriage is going to complete you as part of it. And I think it's partly about what happens in relationships. I mean, you change in a marriage. I don't know that you necessarily control the way that you change or control the way that the other person changes. And I think that in a lot of ways we put a lot of pressure on marriages to be better than they are because we're not very good at thinking about those relationships around the marriage that we need to keep it going. And we're not very good at having conversations about how we negotiate gender relationships within a marriage. I think, speaking as someone in a heterosexual marriage, I'm probably best qualified to talk about the way that gender plays into that. But again, I think I've found that for me, a lot of conflict has come from feeling like there's a particular role that I'm supposed to play in a marriage, not really wanting to play that role, partly because it's boring and I hate washing up, partly because I really am worried about becoming the sort of woman who does the washing up all the time and things like that. And I think that probably as a church, we need to get better at talking about how we negotiate conflict and how we deal with those things and all the things that are really terrifying about marriage. So it really terrifies me that if I were to have kids, that would almost certainly damage my career. I would almost certainly end up doing the majority of the childcare, not because my husband doesn't care or doesn't like kids, but because he earns more than me because of the job he's picked. And that freaks me out, actually. Like, I'm really scared of being trapped. And I wonder how much the sorts of conflicts that we have in marriage are to do with just not being able to talk about that stuff. Gender roles have changed hugely. Our expectations of marriage have changed hugely. Mm. And often we talk as though it's the fault of the other person, whereas I think often it's a lot to do with the way that our individual relationship plays into kind of bigger questions about what it means to be married, about what it means to have a relationship.
Yes to all that, and it was said earlier, when you're in a contracted relationship with someone, it compels you to have to deal with things. If it's a come-day-go-day kind of relationship, if there's something that's difficult, you can choose whether to engage with it or not. You can choose whether to walk away or not. When you wake up alongside the same person day after day, that's both an opportunity and a real problem. But if you're going to keep doing it, then you know, you either address things or you shrivel up and die. So I don't think it's about marriage. I hope I wasn't sort of saying earlier that a marriage is a way of completing someone or that it'll fulfill you, just that it's a particular opportunity. It's a particular way that presents a chance to resolve some things, some of which you could do in other ways as well. But because you're bought into it, because you're kind of tied into something, which at the very least is going to take a very serious decision to walk out of, it just kind of... I'm not very good at doing stuff I don't want to do, to be frank. And there are some things I'm just about getting around to that really, I'm sure Ms. Mackay would say, I should have been dealing with a good 13 or 15 years ago. But one of these days I will get around to dealing with them because they're in my face.
Okay, I think it's one at the back.
Thank you. I think in Christian relationships, in Christian marriages, we're very bad at asking for help, particularly from the church. When you're a married couple in a church, you sort of go with the flow of things. And sometimes when there are difficulties, you're then thinking, well, this is my extended family, but I don't want to talk to them. A couple of churches back, we had a really brilliant community. We were all of a very similar age. We ran a marriage course, very twee, but it had some very, very fundamental things like some people are draw openers and some people are draw closers. And who is prepared to accept the other one's jobs? So I take on the draw closing in my relationship. And the other thing was about opportunity to speak. And sometimes, as Chris was saying, that needs to be taught. And we had one lesson that was about having an issue tissue. If you are holding the tissue, then it's your turn to speak. And then the other person is not allowed to speak until you've passed them the tissue. Then they have to repeat back to you what you've just said so that they understand what you've spoken about and then they can respond. And I think those are very fundamental things, but I suppose my question would be, how in the church can we offer this out rather than it just being this twee? It was very old, it was probably done in the 80s and it was probably quite a nightmare if we put it on the video player today. So should the church be looking at doing something a bit more modern and engaging marriage as a continuing progression?
Thank you. There's one down here, I think. I think there was one over there, wasn't it? Yeah. One here, and then one three rows back.
Thank you. But thank you for your contributions. And I really think they're all valuable, and I can see you've followed, you know, a Hegelian model of debate, which, you know, is how many debates, you know, take their course. But there is something that has concerned me throughout, and maybe it's a bit of a white elephant, which is the massive Commons majority we saw in the last 12 months and how we can explicitly address the issue of gay marriage, which is, you know, an American institution and rapidly becoming one, and which will be introduced to this country. And it seems to me that's just an anxiety I felt throughout the course of the conversations, really.
I'm going to go on to the third chap there as well.
Thank you very much. A question to do with the C of E's preface to the marriage service, where a very strong analogy is built about Christ and the church as being the relationship of marriage on which all focus is really in their preface. And the richness of that self-giving, self-sacrificial, which I see as the very heart of that relationship, that when a couple are married, and in fact in any other relationship to some extent, love is based upon self-giving, mutual self-giving, even self-sacrificial giving as the kind of motif for marriage and maybe for all loving relationships. Do the panel see that as a rich vein from all the discussion we've had so far about the kind of difficulties in relationships, as that is a motif of mutual self-giving as the kind of solution?
Thank you. I think we've had quite a range of views there. John, would you like to say something or respond?
Yes, I mean, I'm going to pick up something that was said two ago. It seems to me that the church has an incredible potential for allowing people or enabling people to speak about things which are important, but seems in most places to be singularly unable to organise that. So we spend an inordinate amount of time talking about leaking roofs and replacing pews or hymnals or how much we're going to pay the organist. And the issues of how we sustain marriage in an era when people are living longer than they did before. I mean, let's be quite frank. I mean, you know, in the past, people died when they came to retirement age. You know, my granny died when she was 63. My grandfather died when he was 66. He was wearying to go home to see Mary. Although, if you'd seen my grandmother, I don't think that was a very attractive prospect. She was a funny old doll. And now people are living longer. So how do we sustain the fervour in a relationship? And that cannot be done simply by one-to-one counselling. The thing about which I enjoy about being in this conversation is I have nothing to defend. I am not married, and I don't have children. So I'm not going to talk out of my own experience. But I can look at a whole realm of people who I interact with, some of whom are single, some of whom are partnered, some of whom are married. And you can see things that are healthy across the board. And you can see that where people talk with each other about what makes for a good marriage and are able to own with each other their successes and also the things which go wrong, then people have got different models and different examples that they can draw on. The same is true of child rearing. You know, one of the things that we suffer from, I suppose, now with the lack of extended families is that very few parents have a model as to how to bring up a child, or a grandmother or an uncle around the corner who can step in and can add some advice. And the last thing we ever do as a church which believes in family values is to say, let us get all the people in this church together who have kids between the age of 5 and 10, and we'll talk about when to say no. It's a thing that every parent is confronted with. And you know, some of the remedy of the kind of malaise that we feel about marriage has to do with the fact that the things which happen within marriage are kept for the individual and for a counsellor. And I think what we need to do is to provide forums where people, as we live longer, just talk openly about what has worked for them and the kind of tissue conversation that may have come from the 80s, but maybe it has to be reinvented.
Chris.
Absolutely. I share your frustration, John, because I work a lot with large groups. Now, church is one of the very few places where large groups of people come together with the genuine expectation there's going to be some real, meaningful, intimate interaction. Lots of people, I mean, Cardiff last year was a wonderfully intimate occasion, but we didn't actually connect, did we? You know, church, there is an expectation that you will look other people in the eye and that you will have something to say to each other, and yet somehow we forget to do it. And we could do more of that, and particularly, I agree with you, John, it's a disaster for me to sit down with a couple on my own. I hate doing it. When I can get three or four couples together in a group, then something very, very different happens, because quite frankly, they're much better at helping each other than I am. But back to what you were talking about, the nature of relationships, and you were talking about being selflessly giving, or people often talk about should you aim to be independent as a person or interdependent within a marriage, those sorts of things. And the word dependent tends to have got a bad press, both sort of in its sort of technical psychological sense, but also in more kind of pop psychology. I actually think that a good adult position is a position of mutual dependence. There are things that I depend on Leslie for massively, as I depend on my children for and depend on for others, but they also depend on me. And where there's a mutuality in that dependence, then that's where your kind of equality and balance is allowed to happen. Where you have one person in a dependent relationship to the other, then that's much more problematic. But finding ways of becoming mutually dependent, open to the giving of others and being willing to give ourselves, that I think is quite a useful blueprint.
Thanks. I think there's somebody in the front row there. Okay, that's two, I think, actually. Yep, this one, and then the chap in blue.
I've been married for 42 years, and I'm still learning. My wife would agree with that. She's not here. It's been a long curve, and I think the biggest thing I'm still learning is about the interdependency thing between us, encouraging each other to actually forge new areas of exploration. And that way we encourage each other because that feeds back to us. I'm also a minister, and I have, over the last 25 years, had many weddings. All of them, I have to say, I have said quite clearly there will be a marriage preparation course, and I will officiate at that wedding when you finish the course. And I will not marry anybody unless they've done the course. And no one refused. Many of them were people who had been, this is their second marriage. There was damage, there was all sorts of things for them to share together under guidance. And again, I think this is where the church actually was, hopefully, was operating properly. And one of the questions I asked was, at your first marriage, were you given marriage preparation? And 99 times out of 100, it was no. And that's again where the church has actually let people down.
Thank you. And the chap in blue.
Thank you. I'm Ray. I'm a very happily married man. And over my experience of marriage, it's a bit like a triune. It's a bit like the three strands about God, your wife, and you as an individual. But I look at it from an intelligence perspective. And we are born, you know, we have got a conscious and we have a subconscious. We have an intellectual brain. We also have an emotional brain. And a lot of that problems come in marriages because we're not emotionally aware. So we carry a lot of our past baggage, if you like, and we tend to take that out on the other person. So part of our relationship is about we're dealing with all that baggage and that emotional stuff. And there's the final part of the intelligence, which is your spiritual intelligence, your intelligence with God. And a lot of the emotional stuff tends to get in the way of our relationships. And that's where most relationships fail. That's where we use aggression. We use, you know, fight, flight, and freeze, and all those emotional parts of our intelligence to actually defend ourselves. And in relationships, that's easy to defend yourself aggressively in that relationship because they're the easiest person to attack. So once you get the emotional intelligence right, and therapy does that very well, actually, you can then, as a couple, work on your spiritual relationship with God. And that's where the triune comes in. That's where the three strings that we talked about actually work fantastically well. And that's what I believe.
Thank you very much. There's one young lady back there. Right, actually, there she is. She's over there. And there's one through here. I'm aware that people are sort of beginning to slip out, and I thought if we could carry on for another 5 minutes, and then if you wanted to stay and talk with the panel, then that would be fine. So we'll do another 5 minutes of the sort of debate in the round, and then if you want to stay for a few minutes, we can carry on then. So on there.
Question was actually for the lady that was sitting here, but hopefully someone in the audience, along with the panel, can help. As a young person who marriage in my relationship is years off, and it's a frightening thing to talk about. When would you say is the good time to get married? Obviously, you say you got married, then you started doing kids and mortgage and things like that, and you feel you're developing, you don't feel fully married yet. And obviously, there's a lady here that said she married people who, in your eyes, were already married. They'd done all that, they'd ticked all the boxes. Whereabouts is it that you draw the line that you should get married, or should you wait until you know you can tick all the boxes? It's a really confusing question to ask. But
that sounds like a $1,000 question, actually.
Yeah,
would each of the panel in turn like to say, when's the ideal time to get married?
Are you sure that the person you ought to be asking this?
Well, it's kind of just a generic, because obviously your point was you got married, then though you started ticking those boxes, and she was saying she'd already ticked all those boxes with those people, and then they got married. Obviously, I wanted to ask the question to her as well, but to you, do you think that was the best way to go about it?
I don't think you can tick boxes. I mean, that is like, you know, if you get 99% right, then you're made for each other. You have to allow for the fact that emotional relationships between people are mystical. You know, this is not new agey, but they are. You know, you look at some people who psychologically are exact opposites, and they have a magnificent marriage. Now, if they'd ticked all the boxes beforehand, they'd never have gone anywhere near each other. So I don't, you know, I think you just have to say there's a time for every season, and that's it. If we could determine exactly when couple A or couple B or couple C should get married, we'd turn it into an automatic reflex, and we'd take away the mystery of love.
Thank you very much. There's one here at the front.
I do find a bottle of Jack Daniels can help.
And then there's one back there. So there's one back there, then I'll just,
hi.
Sorry.
Hi, guys. I used to be a member of a gym in London, and because it had a swimming pool, it cost £45 a month. And I found that because I'd spent my £45 a month, I very rarely went. Do we put too much pressure on modern weddings because people are spending £20,000, £30,000? Are we putting too much? Is it right that famous people get married and we know it's not really real? Do we put too much pressure on the idea that the man has to ask, or that the woman has to wear white, or that at some point you have to work out whose surname you take, or, no, God forbid, whose surname the kids take? Are we putting, I know we're talking about marriage and I think it's beautiful and I believe in this idea of marriage, but to me, I feel like the wedding has become the problem. I think that's the white elephant at the moment.
I think, kind of responding to your question, but also to a few things that other people have said, I think the thing that bothers me most about the idea of marriage is that it means that we think that we know what healthy relationships look like, and that model is often a really cheap model. So you start going out with someone, you have a massive wedding, you buy a house, you have kids, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was in a relationship, and they were kind of at a stage where they were trying to work out whether they wanted to stay together, and that was partly about what they did with their jobs, that was partly about whether they had kids. And I was talking to her, and she said that she'd had lots of people in church ask her about her relationship, and the questions they had asked her were, are you going to get married, and are you sleeping together? And no one had ever asked her, are you happy? Is this relationship working? Are you helping each other become better? And I have been to so many Christian talks about relationships, and they've almost always been about how to not have sex before you're married, whether you can have sex before you're married, how to keep having sex after you're married.
I missed that one.
There was a woman in my church who really liked talking about her sex life. And I have done a marriage preparation course, and honestly, none of those have really helped me at all in my relationship. I think some of them have made caused problems in the way that I think about love and sex and all of those things. And pretty much everything I've learned, I think, that has been really valuable to me in my marriage has been learning what it means to be friends with people and to deal with conflict. And for me, that's happened in church, but it hasn't happened because of talks I've been to. It's been because of trying to work out what it means to live in community with people. And we're really bad as a church at talking about that stuff. What does it mean to actually be friends with people? What does it mean to love each other? What does it mean to challenge each other in ways that aren't just sort of judging people? How do we get better at being friends and being community and sharing our lives? And I sort of wonder whether actually it might not be really good for us if we backed off the idea that marriage was this thing that Christians have to be really enthusiastic about, that everyone has to do, because actually I think it becomes a burden that weighs people down and it stops us asking the questions that really matter. What would happen if we just stopped talking about marriage for a bit, so people could stop thinking of us as the people who are constantly judging their relationships and judging them to be inadequate, and we started talking about what it means to love each other, and acknowledging that that's really difficult. It's really difficult to love another person and to do that wisely and to do that well, and I don't think we talk about it enough, and I worry sometimes that marriage is the reason that we don't do that, because we think we know what it looks like.
Well done. Chris.
In terms of lots of thoughts all the time, you know, the thing about gay marriage, I mean, coming off the back of what you've just said, well, let's just stop talking about it as a matter of morality and let's try and think about it as a matter of human rights. That would be a helpful place, I think, to start on that. And when it comes to weddings, why can't we get a bit more creative? I remember when we were heading up towards our wedding and finding out where we could source Welsh gold, because that was when most gold still came from South Africa, and we didn't want, as we found before, and what were we going to do about not changing one of our names or both of our names or either our names, and a friend saying, well, actually the creative thing to do is make your own name. Now, we didn't do that. Leslie Mackay stayed a Mackay because she's a Mackay, and she's proud of that, and there's no sons in her family, and without that, the name's going to be lost. So she kept her name, and we had a party, but we got married with 12 people, our immediate families. A couple of friends cooked for us. We went away on holiday, and we came back, and some friends in church organized, I suppose what you'd call a reception for us. It was a party. There were 200 people there, mostly from the streets around where we lived, and we'd given these friends £100 to organize this party. Look at me, you know this was in the early Middle Ages, but believe me, even then, £100 wasn't a lot. And at the end of the party, Jeff came up to me and pressed something into my hand. I said, what's this, Jeff? He said, it's your change.
Oh, bless.
And they'd run a party for 200 people with, there were four or five different main courses. Everybody, just by people cooking stuff for themselves. And, you know, if you want a wedding, make a wedding that really matters for you. And there is something about the commodification of it, because in a way that's a bit of what you're saying. We use other words for it in church, but it becomes another way of controlling people. And actually what any good relationship, particularly a married relationship, needs is find ways of defining its own parameters and setting out on the kind of relationship it wants to be and the kind of stamp that it's going to have.
Thank you, Chris. There's one more. In fact, there's quite a lot more, actually, so we'll just carry on. If you're happy, we'll just carry on. Is that all right? Okay, we'll keep going.
I'd just like to say something about weddings. About 6 years ago now, the Church of England did a major, major piece of work talking to over 2,500 couples about what it meant to them to be married and what it meant to them to be married in church and what the difference was between a wedding and a marriage. And we need to be very careful about assuming that people having a wedding have shallow aspirations and that spending money on it means that they don't take their marriage seriously, because what we discovered was that being married and having a wedding in church was a very aspirational thing for couples, and that the language they use to talk about wedding and marriage may not be our language, but underneath that they have real hopes and spiritual thoughts about it, and they really want to take it seriously. So the two things, spending the money and it being not taken seriously, are not the same thing at all.
Before we lose anybody else, I just want to say thank you to the panel, because I know people are going, but please will you say thank you traditionally to Marika, John and Chris. Thank you.
Can I just pick up a wee thing about marriages? I think that churches have to rethink what they do with marriages, because we're dealing with an institution which is celebrated in a way which was appropriate in the 16th century and now is well past its sell date. I now will not marry anybody who is in a relationship, a sexual relationship, with another person unless they promise that there'll be none of this walking down the aisle with a white dress and suddenly letting go of your father's arm to pick up the arm of somebody whom he approves of. That is a medieval ritual which has no place in the Christian church. And so I'll say to people, if I'm going to marry you, you both will be at the church not 20 minutes late, dear. The two of you will stand there and you will introduce each other's family and friends to each other. And then if you want to come in and walk down the side aisles and kiss in the middle, I don't care. But you've invited people to your wedding, so you'll welcome at the door. And we will not have a wedding in which you stand, having invited people to witness the wedding, and all they see are your backsides. You know, the reason why we do this is because Hollywood changed marriage. Up until about 1910, most people were married in very humble circumstances, often not in a church, but in the church hall or in the vicarage or whatever, with only two witnesses. My grandparents had that done to them, and my parents almost were in that situation. The big thing which people splash out in is a Hollywood invention which we've bought into. And while for some people that is an expression of their love and all the rest, that's fine. But when that becomes the model to which others aspire, and you have the wedding organizer and everybody else chipping in and getting their bit, then you're inviting people to role play something for which they've had no rehearsal. Hollywood weddings are all set up by people who know how to act in public and to speak and all the rest of it. Most people when they get married are really quite kind of nervous. But if they ask people to come and witness their wedding, the community should be around them and they should not be facing the priest. And as for the thing about, you know, say after me, I, Robert, take you, Janice. Well, actually, my name is John and not Robert, and Janice, I'm sorry, but I don't think we'd go very far together. Why do we do that? Because we believe that people can't read. It goes back to the days when people were illiterate. And that and many other things have to be scrapped, and we need new models of engagement when people covenant themselves to each other, which get rid of a whole lot of the antediluvian nonsense.
I think you can't really follow that, so I'm going to stop. So thank you for a great evening. I think you've been a fantastic panel, all of you, and thank you to you three. You've been wonderful. Good night.